This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, I believe it's now 5:30, so I would like to call this meeting to order. If you're still, Wendy, if you could still admit people in as they come in, I'm about going to take a roll call in just a minute here. But first, I want to call everyone's attention to the instructions that were just placed, that Nick just placed in the chat window. So in order to better facilitate voting as well as the breakout rooms, we would like for everyone to append to the end of your name. If you're any member, please put your division name after your full name. Before your full name. Okay, I'm sorry. Whatever the instructions say. So that could be either the professional schools, whether it's Vet, Law, Johnson, or social sciences or humanities, physical sciences or life sciences. So whichever breakout division you have decided to be affiliated with as of last meeting, please do that. And if you are a voting member, please prepend the letter V to the beginning of your name so that if we happen to be voting at all today, then we can be sure to count, make sure we're counting the voting members properly. So please do that now. I'll give maybe 1 minute for everyone to take a minute to do that, and then I will begin the roll call. Okay, and Wendy, is the person who is supposed to be taking the roll call present now, or should I go ahead and do it myself?
I'm not sure. I don't see Terrell on. There was someone that was on with a phone number, so that might have been him because he wanted the phone information.
Terrell, if you're here, can you please make yourself known?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, I can hear you, yes. Could you please... You can please go ahead and take the roll call, please.
Yeah. Okay, just 1 second. Let me pull up the PowerPoint.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, there it is. So I'm going to do it by the alphabetical order for voting member. I don't have the PowerPoint for by the divisions.
Okay, go ahead and do it that way then. As long as it's up to date, then it should be fine.
Yeah. So starting off, Ruth Barinkovich. Karina Beras. Hannah Bridiger Curtis.
Here.
Allison Bidgerano.
Here.
Ethan Cole. Mila Kantar. Martik Chatterjee.
Sure.
Amanda Cirillo. Peyton Cole.
Here.
Hannah Cole.
Here.
Nicola Danev.
Here.
Jordan Doxel. Cody Duell.
Here.
Madeline Keefe.
Here.
Kavya Krishnan.
Here.
Casey Laurent.
Here.
Stephanie Lopez.
Here.
Tim Littermoser.
Here.
Ryan Maloney. Catherine Masters. Christine Oanewa.
Here.
Matt Schaffler.
Here.
Emery Schoenley.
Here.
Alicia Sontag. Matthew Sturgeon.
Here.
Paul Vintage.
Here.
Marvin Wang. Meredith Welch.
Here.
And Heidi Hsu.
Here.
Okay. Yep. We have quorum.
We have quorum. Okay. Thank you very much. So before we move on to the approval of the minutes, I have several announcements I would like to make. I'll try to make them as short as possible because we have a packed agenda and we have many visitors today. So I appreciate you all for coming. So first I want to announce that the university assembly is looking for the GPSA to appoint several members to university assembly committees. So there are three committees that need to be staffed, and each of them needs at least two members who need to be appointed through the GPSA. One of those members has to be a GPSA member, and the second person can be any graduate student who is interested in participating in the committee, although they can also be a GPSA member if we can't find any particular individual. So what I'm going to do real quick is I'm going to list out the names of the committees of the University Assembly who are looking for appointments and give a brief description. And if anyone is interested, please contact me directly or anyone on the executive committee if you are interested. So the first committee is the Codes and Judicial Committee. And this is the delegation of the assembly that reviews any resolution related to the campus code of conduct and the recruitment and appointment of members to the university hearing and review board. So this is obviously a very important one due to recent events. Nick Danev, I believe, is interested in being one of the appointments. So there is another opportunity available. The second committee is the Campus Welfare Committee, which considers resolutions related to diversity and inclusion, family support, health services, and any other topic deemed relevant to campus welfare by the executive board of the UA. So again, we need two appointments for that committee. And the last committee is the Campus Infrastructure Committee, which reviews any proposed motion related to environmental impact and sustainability, information technology, transportation and commuter policies, and any other topic deemed relevant to campus infrastructure. So again, if you are interested in being involved in the university assembly on either of those committees, please get in contact with us. And just remember, so one of them has to be a GPSA member, and the other person can be any graduate student. So please be in communication with your constituents and see if anyone has a particular interest in any of these particular committees. Next announcement, the reminder to submit a public comment on the campus code of conduct revision is 5 p.m. on Tuesday, November 17th. We have one resolution today dealing with the campus code of conduct, so we look forward to hearing about that. Although we do encourage everyone to comment as individuals and to carry on this this information to your constituents. You can find the proposed campus code of conduct on the University Assembly page, and you can find it very easily just by Googling it too. We'd be happy to share the link as well. The graduate student elected trustees, on this Wednesday from 7 to 8:30 p.m., I will moderate the candidate forum, and I'm developing questions for the candidates. In addition to questions from the audience, I'm responsible for basically considering questions of our own that are kind of fielded from the graduate program as a whole. So if you cannot come to that forum, I am welcome to any suggestions on questions that I should pose to the candidates. We also happen to have the candidates here today to introduce themselves, which we'll get to in a few moments. But if you, for whatever reason, we don't have a whole lot of time for debate or Q&A today for the candidates. So please feel free to send me to any proposed questions that you may have. Next, the Public Safety Advisory Committee requires a new graduate student representative. It's currently being, we're currently being represented by Nate Rogers, who is the former GPSA president, but his graduation is coming up very soon, so we need to find a new replacement. This is a very important committee for very obvious reasons, and if I can quote him explaining why this is important, he says, PSEC is now being led directly by Joanne DiStefano, and at the request of President Pollack, are about to undertake an ambitious rethink of safety and security at Cornell. While the outright disbanding of CUPD is off the table, essentially everything else is fair game for us to consider. We're going to be consolidating and analyzing quantitative data stretching back several years, as well as surveying the campus community and forming focus groups to gather new information on a wide range of topics. The final product will be a strategic plan for safety and security at Cornell, where it is my personal hope, this is Nate speaking, that our university can lead the nation from the front, employing our unique ability to act as a living learning laboratory instead of seeking to hide behind industry best best practices that are falling short of the needs of our community. So the PSAC is now meeting every other week on Zoom, and it lasts about 1 hour, and I believe it's every other Friday. And if you or someone you know is interested in representing graduate students on this very important committee, please get in contact with the executive committee as soon as possible. And Nate would also like to add that women appointees are especially encouraged to apply because by law, women must comprise at least half of the committee's composition. Okay. If there are any questions about that, please feel free to email me. My net ID is DG567. But for now, I would like to move on to our next order of business, which is the approval of the minutes for Monday, October 12th, 2020, our previous meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any objections?
I actually have an amendment to offer.
To the minutes?
Yes.
Okay, please state your amendment.
So on page 7, it's section F. I haven't listened to a recording of my exact statement, so it's possible that what I said didn't come across exactly the point that I intended to emphasize. But something I noticed that was missing there was an emphasis on the concern of health insurance premiums, not just funding generally, but specifically the issue of how health insurance is covered during leave of absence. And I was hoping to amend the minutes, to bring that point more to the fore. I think that's more in the spirit of what I said. And if it's not, it's definitely what I meant to say.
So can just to clarify exactly what point in the minutes are you considering?
I'm sorry. So page 7, F, the last sentence. Additionally, T. Luder Moser noted the process for TA sick leaves as well as funding regarding health leave absence.
This is not page numbers.
It's the second to last page. If that
second helps. To last page, okay.
Yeah.
And which point on it is it?
F.
F. Okay.
And then the last sentence of that.
Okay, so the current last sentence says, additionally, T. Loder Moser noted that the process for TA sick leavers was unclear as well as funding regarding a health leave of absence and stated that the funding would stay in place, but it would be important to make sure that it did. And how would you like to amend that sentence?
So, would it help if I sent it to the chat as well as read it out loud?
Why don't you, if you could please do that, if it won't take too much time, yes.
I wrote it up 5 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
Additionally, T. Luder Moser noted that the process for TA sick leaves was unclear, as well as funding regarding leaves of absence. T. Luder Moser emphasized a concern regarding health insurance premiums being covered during a leave of absence, so that students on leave of absence, particularly those on health leave of absence, are not faced with increased healthcare costs, and that it would be important to make sure that this is true or to advocate for making it so.
Okay. So that is the amendment. I believe now we can enter some formal debate on this amendment. Is there anyone who would like to speak for or against this amendment? Seeing none, is there a motion to approve this amendment to this addition to the minutes?
Motion to approve the amendment.
Is there a second?
Seconded.
Any objections? Okay, seeing none, the minutes are now amended to include this additional language at point F under the public forum section. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So now, just a kind of a point of order, maybe Nick, you can answer this. Do we need to now postpone approving the minutes until next time, or can we still move forward with approving the minutes, including this amendment?
No, we can approve both the amendment and the minutes.
Okay, is there a motion then to approve the minutes, including this amended language?
Yes, motioning.
Okay, motion, is there a second?
Second,
any objections? Seeing none, the minutes are hereby approved. Okay, moving on to the next order of business is, we had under the agenda elections. So the reason we had this was that Mardik was, as you know, was recently elected to VP of operations. And we had assumed, since he was the previous chair of the student advisory committee, that this would imply that this chair would then be open and that we would have elections today. But by my understanding is that it is possible for him to hold both positions if he so wishes. But Marduk, if you're here, could you please maybe state your intentions of what you would like to do in terms of holding this position? Would you like to maintain your chair of this committee, at least for now? Would you like to resign from it today and hope to hold an election, or would you like to do something different?
I would like to correct you first. It was the Student Advocacy Committee and not Student Advisory Committee.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I would ideally like to resign the student chair of the Student Advocacy Committee and just be VP Operations. If there is someone running for the Student Advocacy Committee, until and unless that is filled, I would like to continue. But if someone wants to be the SSC, I would like to resign.
Okay, so you're saying that you would like for us to go forward and kind of go forward for elections, but if there are no candidates, then you'll stay on. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, well, in that case, let me go ahead and just read quickly the description, and then I will open it up for nominations. So if I have it right here. The Student Advocacy Committee. This committee works to act on issues of stipend levels, mental and physical health, childcare, diversity, and the general well-being of all graduate and professional students. The committee holds one town hall meeting each year, usually in the spring, in order to solicit feedback from the graduate professional student community on specific issues. To assist in the committee's charge in addressing issues of graduate mental health and wellness, it is recommended that the Student Advocacy Committee form a focus group of its members to meet with university administrators, health services, and the Dean of Student Offices regularly. So are there any questions about what this committee entails that maybe Marduk could help answer? If not, then I will now open it up for nominations for the chair of the Student Advocacy Committee.
Can I put forward a motion?
Nick, you're recognized. Yeah.
Motion to table until the next meeting.
Okay. There's been a motion to table this this election until the next meeting. Is there a second to that?
Second.
Any objections? Seeing none, this election for the SAC chair has been tabled until the following meeting. Okay. Now I would like to move on to presentations. Our first presenter for today is Associate Judicial Administrator Christina Lang, whose primary role and responsibilities include investigating and resolving referrals to the OJA. Christina also currently serves on the Bias Assessment and Review Team, and she has been called today to present on the Code of Conduct topic. So, Christina, you are now recognized to speak. Are you present?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, please, you're welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone, for inviting both, I would say, the representatives from the JA's office as well, the JCCs, to share your space this evening. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of our office this evening. And just for the point of clarification, I just want to make sure my information is correct. Do I have approximately 10 minutes? I just want to respect everyone's time.
Yes, you have 10 minutes. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Feel free to cut me off at any point you want me to stop talking. So,
okay.
For those of you who are, I have not yet met, my name is Christina Lee, and I serve as an Associate Judicial Administrator in the Office of the Judicial Administrator. Barbara Krause, who is currently serving as our interim, is unavailable this evening, which is why I will be here speaking on behalf of our office this evening. So, as you all know, as David had mentioned, the fall 2020 proposed amendments to the code are currently available for public commenting. And I hope that you all, as leaders within shared governance and a member of our Cornell community, will review and, of course, share your comments to the proposed changes to this very important university policy. I will say, as a whole, the JA's office does support the fall 2020 proposed amendments to the Campus Code of Conduct. I'll offer some additional context from our office as to why we took this position, as well as some concerns that we do have and suggestions that remain. The JA's office notes that there are a number of changes in the proposed amendments that we believe to be fundamentally important. Most significantly, we believe the proposed code moves student conduct under the umbrella of student and campus life, which we believe is fundamentally important. The proposed code also applies to students only, and of course, this includes our graduate and professional students, removing provisions related to faculty and staff that has in the past rarely resulted in referrals to the JA's office. The proposed code applies to all university recognized and registered student organizations and living groups, which would therefore include our social sororities and fraternities. The amendments also require that every individual involved in the implementation of the campus code of conduct must receive ongoing training that's focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we believe that that is extremely important. The code provisions overall, we believe, are more coherent, less procedurally burdensome, and we would also say they are less adversarial in its implementation compared to the current code of conduct. And finally, the code procedures that are presented right now explicitly favor alternative dispute resolution as well as summary resolution in lieu of formal hearing options. And so the JA's office believes that the items that we just reviewed will fundamentally recast and improve Cornell's approach to student conduct in a way that benefits complainants, respondents, as well as the Cornell community more broadly. In addition to supporting the fall 2020 amendments as a whole, the JA's office will also offer the following comments and suggestions in some areas that we believe remain concerns for us. And we've identified three kind of in light of time that we have with you this evening. So the first is on the key issue of what standard of proof should be applied. The JA's office does strongly favor the preponderance of evidence standard. We recognize that this is potentially a point of major concern for our Cornell community. There have already been comments and lengthy discussions regarding the standard of proof. And as I always say to students, colleagues, friends, family, you know, reasonable people can disagree, and I understand that there may be disagreement on this point. Second, the JA's office is proposing a substitute definition of the hazing provision that is currently proposed. We strongly urge to be at least as broad as Cornell's current definition of hazing. And finally, the JA's office continues to have concerns regarding the proposed structure of the student codes counselor. And so I'd like to spend a little bit of time just talking a little bit about each of those three points and elaborating a bit there, starting off with the preponderance of evidence standard. The JA's office, again, strongly urges the adoption of the preponderance standard for student conduct matters because we believe it best balances the rights of the accused student, which would be the respondent, the rights of the complainant or victim in a particular incident, and the rights of Cornell's educational community as a whole. The preponderance standard puts complainants and respondents on equal footing and allows disciplinary action to be taken when evidence establishes that it is more likely than not that an alleged violation did occur. The clear and convincing evidence standard, which is our current standard, on the other hand, puts respondents in a considerably more favorable position compared to that of a complainant or a victim who must meet a significantly higher threshold of evidence in order to achieve the secure and nourishing educational environment which the code exists to protect. And so use of the preponderance standard, just a little bit of additional context, the use of that standard within higher education, specifically in a student conduct process, is favored by the Association for Student Conduct Administration, ASCA, which is kind of the professional organization that a lot of student conduct officers belong to. This is also the leading national organization that's devoted to developing and supporting our student conduct professionals. Moreover, I will say that other student conduct processes and procedures that exist currently at Cornell also use the preponderance of evidence standard, including adjudications of alleged conduct matters pertaining to fraternity and sorority misconduct, and adjudications under policy 6.4, which is the policy that governs prohibited bias, discrimination, harassment, and sexual and related misconduct. The JA's office believes that the same standard should be used and applying across all types of behavioral conduct matters. We acknowledge that disciplinary action against a student, especially in the circumstances where a disciplinary record may be created, is of great concern to students. Respectfully, I think based on our experience in being the office that's responsible for reporting student conduct records, the JA's office does believe that this particular student concern on this point generally does not reflect or mirror the reality of the repercussions for having a student conduct record. In any event, we do believe that more fundamentally that membership in the Cornell community is a privilege rather than a right, and the community should be able to enforce its standards of behavior based on an evidentiary standard that balances all the members of the community as well as the community itself. So that's the context we would like to provide pertaining to the standard of proof. Our second point, which is to propose a revised definition of what is currently proposed for the hazing definition. So Cornell, like other colleges and universities across the country, has recognized hazing as a public health issue. President Pollack has consistently taken a firm stance against hazing and demonstrated her commitment to achieving a culture change within our campus. The current fall 2020 proposed code definition of hazing, however, is narrower than the definition in the current code of conduct. The JA's office believes that it's absolutely critical to define hazing broadly in order to educate students on the harmful behaviors of hazing and eliminate it from campus. The JA's office will provide our comments on the public commenting page, of course, as well as our website in the coming days that will articulate in full our proposed definition of hazing. And so just basically the format of the hazing definition makes it a little bit difficult, I think, in this forum to kind of share what we are proposing, but that will be available both on our website as well as on the public commenting website. So I will ask you to take a look at that if you're interested. And finally, the JA's office has continued concern about the proposed structure of the student code's counselors. We acknowledge that the proposed structure in the 2020 proposed code procedures, specifically section 2.2, represents a compromise of ideas that were proposed in the CJC and the Office of Student Advocate versions of the code that were submitted back in the spring of 2020 to the University Assembly. And the JA's office is, you know, prepared to accept that compromise, understanding that within shared governance that exists, because we believe that the positive changes reflected in these proposed procedures far outweigh some of our concerns. However, we believe that even as reworked, the structure of the student code's counselors remain problematic. And among other concerns, we've identified four, and so I will just share those with you. The first is that the benefit of independence of the student code's counselors under the proposed structure is outweighed by the fact that the structure removes them from student and campus life professionals. And from broader conversations about Cornell's philosophy and approach to student development, including the educational and restorative goals of the student conduct process. Second, the concept of separate offices for complainants, codes, counselors, and respondents, codes, counselors, we believe unnecessarily perpetuates an adversarial approach in student conduct proceedings. Third, we believe the student conduct counselors are selected, as proposed, they are selected and can only be removed by the student assembly, the graduate and professional student assembly, and the office of the student advocate. The proposed amendment suggests that the director only has a consultative role in these functions. And it is unclear to us how, as written, these three large and independent shared governance bodies will be able to fulfill what would otherwise be supervisory responsibilities of professional staff members. And finally, the student code's counselors are to receive administrative support from the university. It is unclear, however, based on how things are written right now, what office would provide that administrative support. As stated before, the JA's office will, of course, accept the proposed structure of the student code's counselors as a compromise to move forward with this comprehensive revision of Cornell's conduct code. We believe, however, a better structure would be to have these advisors located administratively under student and campus life. I know I'm low on time, so I just want to take another. Just,
yeah.
That's okay. And I will just note that the comment that we just shared regarding the student codes counselor, please, is not a critique in any way of the judicial codes counselors. Mm-hmm. We have a wonderful relationship working with their office. We believe that, you know, their work is tremendously important. Our views just simply reflect a philosophical difference on how student conduct concerns should be addressed on a college campus. I thank you all for sharing your space, sharing your time. This is such an important conversation that our university is having right now. I'm glad that you've invited me into your space. And I hope everybody is taking care and staying safe and healthy during this time. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're very short on time, but I will allow maybe 1 or 2 minutes of questions for Christina Lang before we move on to our next speaker. So is there anyone who'd like to ask a question for Christina? Please raise your hand in the participants chat now.
I've proposed tabling questions until the second presentation, and that might give people a clear idea of questions.
Okay, I think, yes, because I know our next speaker is speaking on the same topic, so let's go ahead and do that. So please take some time to formulate your question, and then Christina, if you don't mind, maybe making yourself available to answer any of the questions after our next speaker, then let's do that. So, okay, so our next speaker is the Judicial Codes Counselor, Marisa O'Gara. And the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor provides free assistance to any member of the Cornell community accused of violating the campus code of conduct, the code of academic integrity, or Cornell University Policy 6.4. Marisa, you are now acknowledged to speak. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it. I think what might make the most sense is just to react to a couple of the comments that the Judicial Administrator's Office has made about the proposed changes. I could talk about this code all day, and I'm happy to talk offline with anyone who wants to talk about any of the proposed changes. I think it's incredibly important, and I'll just say up front, I think a lot of graduate and professional students don't realize that we are under the code's jurisdiction, so this affects all of you, and it can definitely be overwhelming to comb through all the changes, and I hope that we can be a resource in helping you do that. So with respect to the evidentiary standard, the Judicial Codes Counselors support the clear and convincing evidentiary standard, which is the current one in place, for a couple of reasons. One, the entire reason that the question of changing the evidentiary standard that we've used now for a very long time at Cornell, quite successfully, was because there was a thought that when the new Title IX procedures came out at the federal level, that they were going to require that evidentiary standards be standardized across campus codes. We now know that that's not the case. And so as far as we're concerned, the point is moot, and I'm not sure why it's still up for discussion. But I think from a philosophical standpoint, it also makes sense to have a clear and convincing evidentiary standard, because I think we recognize it's a reflection on the behalf of the university community that the respondent is the one with the most to lose. I think especially when you consider the fact that in the overwhelming majority of the cases, there isn't a student complainant, it's the university that's the complainant. So you have the university against a student who, you know, could have any range of actions up to suspension and expulsion. And I think, you know, it's natural that when any kind of fact finder is considering a case like that, there are going to be doubts. You're never going to be 100% certain. You know, you're going to hear a lot of evidence and a lot of different people speak, but we think it's really important that those doubts are resolved in favor of the person who has so much at stake. And just from the perspective of someone who does this work every single day, I'm now in my third year at the law school and in my second year as Judicial Codes Counselor. I've personally represented over 60 students, undergrads and graduate and professional students, and it is a terrifying thing to have happen to you. And I'll also say that many, many, many students are found responsible. Much more often than not, they are found responsible. So I don't think the university is having any difficulty under the current evidentiary standard that would justify changing it. So those are sort of our main points on that. Moving into the structure and the oversight under the code. So just to be clear, I think the terminology can get a little confusing because some of the office names have changed. So you can assume that Judicial Administrator, which is the current office that Christina works for, is now referred to to as the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. Judicial Codes Counselor, which is my office, is referred to as Respondents Codes Counselors. So first, we don't think it's appropriate that the advisors that are working with complainants also work with respondents. We were glad to see that that was reflected in the current code and that they are separate offices. The law students who work with complainants agree with us on that. We think it's critical that as an office, we can work together. And if you're representing people on both sides of the aisle, it's pretty difficult to collaborate without having any kind of conflict of interest. That would never happen in the legal world. Of course, there are some clear differences between the legal world and our student conduct process, but I think the parallels are similar enough to justify these offices remaining separate. We also think it's very important that the Judicial Codes Counselor's office remains independent. I can tell you that many of my clients tell me that they would never work with an advisor if they didn't trust that we were an independent resource available to them. I think if we're going to say as a university, we think it's important that students have advisors, and it seems like there's broad agreement about that across the board, then we need to make sure that students actually have access to that right. And I know personally, I would not feel comfortable going to an advisor that worked for the office that was charging me with a conduct violation. I think it's totally inappropriate. I think the point that is made to justify it is often one about accountability and integration. My response to that would be you can have integration without a supervisory role. And in terms of accountability, I had, you know, over 10 stakeholders on my hiring committee. I had to go through about 5 different interviews and get confirmed by the university assembly. It's a pretty rigorous process. We have a law school faculty advisor who's been working on code revisions for 20 years, and our clients hold us accountable. So I think it strikes the right balance between accountability and making sure that we're trusted advisors to keep us independent. Christina did not mention this, but I also think along the same lines, it's critical that both respondents and their advisors can continue to speak and ask questions. Under the proposed code, that is only allowed in a case where there's suspension and expulsion on the table. Now, while that's clearly the most, you know, extreme circumstance, and we were glad to see that the right to speak was preserved in that case, we do think that that should be preserved across the board. I think Christina could attest to this because we've been in numerous meetings together, but we don't speak often. We know that people want to hear from the student. We're not trying to make this an over adversarial process, but often when you have an 18-year-old complainant, especially one maybe that speaks English as a second language or has mental health challenges and is anxious, having an advisor who can speak for them, especially one who understands the code, is a really important right to have. And I've had many clients tell me that I'm innocent and I would go to a hearing, but if my advisor can't speak for me, I'm not going to go to that hearing. And we should never have a student not go to a hearing because they're too afraid because they can't be represented properly. So I think it's really critical that we maintain that right for students. Those are sort of the main points. There are other things, you know, I won't take up too much time. I think, you know, the standard for temporary suspensions has been lowered under this proposed code, and I think that is wrong. Right now, if you have a temporary suspension imposed against you, you haven't had a hearing on the merits. You haven't even been found responsible. You're being kicked off campus if you live there. You're not even allowed to go to class over Zoom. There's no reason that we should be lowering the standard and making it easier to do something that serious to a student. And also the new code gets rid of appeals to that process being heard by an independent review panel composed of staff, faculty, and students. Right now it's just student in campus life gets to unilaterally make that decision. I don't know why. You want me to just wrap up one more minute? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I'll just say that I think, you know, we should be, of course, there are extreme circumstances, and if campus safety is in jeopardy, sometimes I think it's inevitable, and we would agree that a temporary suspension has to be imposed, but we should maintain a high standard and make sure there are checks in place when that happens. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Marissa. Are there any questions now for either Marissa O'Gara or Christine Lang? Please raise your hand and be participants. Hannah, you are recognized from Life Sciences.
Hi, thank you so much for speaking up, Marissa. Like, this is such an important issue and I'm behind you 100%. I was wondering if either of you could speak to how this, the changes to this code of conduct compared to other universities.
So if either of you are welcome to jump in and speak on this, maybe Christina, would you like to go first or is there anything, or?
Sure, I'm happy to comment. Yeah. Generally, I will say there are several changes in the proposed amendments that mirror some of the best practices within student conduct. I think that one of the pieces that is important to consider is, of course, every institution has its unique little quirks, if you will. For example, the current code of conduct references, you know, you're not permitted to swim in the gorges. You know, I would venture to guess a lot of other universities don't have a similar type of situation. But there are a lot of parallels that represent situations that are similar at a lot of institutions. Student development theory across the board indicate that students, you know, they tend to make decisions that result in similar violations. If we look at kind of the data, it supports that overwhelmingly first-year students have a lot of similar types of violations, underage drinking, marijuana use, et cetera, et cetera. And so I would say compared to a lot of other institutions, the standard of proof is one piece that if we did move to a preponderance of evidence standard, that would be, I would say over 95% of institutions use that standard of proof. The current proposal utilizes more of an investigator model where even during the formal hearing process, an investigator would no longer be the one who is presenting the case before a hearing panel. So I would say that is also fairly common in student conduct practices. I would say that the fundamental fairness components are remain the same. There are the rights to advisors. There's the right to receive notifications of allegations prior to meeting with the office. Those are some examples I can articulate are similar to a lot of other institutions.
Okay, Marissa, would you like to comment at all on this question?
Very briefly, I'll say, sure. You know, I think on the evidentiary standard, universities go both ways. So I think we really just need to decide what's best for our community. And I would say that we should stick with what has been working well. And then I'll say that Columbia University actually provides attorneys to students when they're involved in the disciplinary process, which, I think that's just an example of a school that is providing free assistance to every student. There are only three or four throughout the country that provide any kind of advisor like we do. And I think I'd like to see more schools expand in that direction. I think it's an important right to have.
Okay, Tim Littermoser, you have a question.
Thank you. Christina, you mentioned that the Association for Student Conduct Administrators supports this evidentiary standard. But are you or Marissa, if you're aware as well, of any national or intercollegiate student groups that have stated recommendations on evidentiary standards in this kind of thing?
Tim, can you just clarify for me what you mean by intercollegiate groups? I was a little confused by that.
Any sort of U.S. Student Association. I don't have one in mind right now, I'll freely admit, but I know organizations like that exist that are organized by predominantly undergrad students that advocate on sort of broad undergrad or student issues, not just undergrad, graduate as well. Organizations like that that I imagine would have opinions on code of conduct issues like this. And I didn't know if their opinions, if we know them right now.
Thank you. I actually can't think of an organization off the top of my head either. The Association for Student Conduct Administration is the professional home of student conduct officers across the nation. And so they're actually an international group too. They have membership from several countries. And so I would say that's what I can speak to, as I'm a member of that organization.
Okay, Marissa, any comments on that question at all, or?
Not directly. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of, okay, of any, but the one thing I would say that's slightly on topic is the The standard is different often in Title IX proceedings as it is here and at other universities. And the reason for that is because it's often a he said, she said kind of situation, and it's hard to get evidence in that case. So we think it makes sense that there's a lower standard of proof in a Title IX proceeding than there is in a campus code of conduct case.
Okay, very briefly, because we need to move on, Ariel Johnson.
Yeah, this is not related to the issues that have been discussed so far. Left a comment on section 4.7 on drug-related behavior, because it seems to be ambiguous on the point of whether or not people are allowed to possess medical marijuana in campus living situations. Could you clarify what the code actually says on this point? Because it does say, you know, including but not limited to possessing drug paraphernalia for the purposes of manufacture, distribution, or dispensation of marijuana or any controlled substances, and people who use medical marijuana would have drug paraphernalia on campus.
So I will say my understanding of the current state of legislation, which this is an example of how it does impact codes of conduct, is that until there is federal rulings pertaining to the use of a controlled substance such as marijuana, whether medical or recreational, the university will adopt, the university will prohibit the use of marijuana on campus. And so pertaining to medical marijuana in New York State, I apologize, that is not my expertise in understanding those rules and regulations, but there are very specific regulations pertaining to the use of that, but currently it is not permitted. It is not permitted for students who have a medical marijuana license to use it on campus.
That it's just concerning because, you know, you're supposed to use medical marijuana at your home address, which would be your campus dorm, but then so they essentially wouldn't be able to use medical marijuana anywhere if they have a chronic pain issue.
I understand your concern. I have not had personal encounters with that type of situation. I would say that part of it might be the way that medical marijuana is consumed in New York State. But I think that is a piece that a student would have to be informed of how they're permitted to use medical marijuana in New York State.
I'm saying that it's not a New York State issue. It's an issue with the campus code of conduct. Sorry, I'll move on.
So it's okay. If last follow up. Or yeah.
No, that's just my point, is that New York State permits people to use medical marijuana in their home residences, but the campus code of conduct as currently written wouldn't permit students with disabilities to use it in their dorm room without facing something like suspension or expulsion.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay, so unfortunately we have to move on, but I'd like to first thank both of our previous two speakers, Christina Lang and Marissa O'Gara, for taking the time to meet with us and speaking. Thank you very much. So our next order of business is the presentations of the graduate student trustee candidates. So there are four candidates who are with us here today. I'm going to call each of you in turn. You'll have about, unfortunately, maybe 3 minutes or so to speak. And then I will open it up for questions that can be directed for any of the candidates. We'll probably have enough time for maybe one or two today. First we have Liz Davis Frost. Are you here?
Yep, that's me.
Hi, you're recognized to speak.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Hey, everyone. My name is Liz. I use she, her pronouns. I first want to echo Christina's ending sentiments and say that I hope everyone's doing okay. And if you're not doing okay, that's okay. I know things are really bleak right now. So I encourage everyone to do what you need to do to take care of yourselves in these difficult times, which includes being kind to yourself, which I sometimes forget and I'm working on. So anyway, thank you all for letting me be here to come speak to you today. I'm really excited to be running for this position and potentially having the honor of further serving the Cornell community. So a little bit about me. I actually just graduated from Cornell undergrad this past semester with my BS in communication and am now pursuing my MPA in SEPA. During undergrad, I was heavily involved in student organization spaces on campus. I mostly did sexual violence prevention and gender equity work, but also was involved with Greek life and other identity-based organizations. So I'm running for this position because I want to address the systemic and institutionalized issues that run very deep in the United States, which have replicated themselves on our campus. I want to create an anti-racism institute that is grounded in equity and inclusion, not just for students, but for faculty, staff, and the greater Cornell and Ithaca communities. I want to hold the university and the administration accountable for the things that they've said they're gonna do, like divesting from fossil fuels and also implementing the recommendations that just came out in this mental health review this past week. And I also wanna ensure that all students have access to the things they need to succeed in an academic setting. So expanding student disability services, resources, that department's very underfunded and I experienced that personally in my undergraduate career, and also expanding the free period product initiative that I spent the past 2 years working on that was finally implemented at the beginning of this semester, which I'm really excited about. So these past 4 years, I learned how to navigate Cornell's bureaucracy and have built working relationships with administrators like VP Lombardi and those in the Dean of Students office, as well as people in student and campus life to get things done and advocate for students' needs. You know, I've done this work for quite a bit, and I want to keep doing this work because I genuinely care about this work. I'm literally getting my MPA because I want to work in higher education to dedicate my life to these issues. So a vote for me would be a vote for a passionate and resilient, experienced leader who knows and loves this campus a lot and will not rest until it's a place where everyone can prosper and do okay and be okay.
Thank you very much, Liz. So our next candidate is Afua Asantewa. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, it's Afua Asantewa.
Afua, I'm sorry. Oh, you're not recognized. Yeah.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name's Afua Asantewa, and I'm an MBA candidate at the Johnson School of Management. I moved to Ithaca from Chicago this summer, and prior to Johnson, I spent 3 years with IBM as a human capital consultant, but also was a driver of our internal hiring strategy for underrepresented minorities. Thank you for the opportunity for me and my fellow candidates to speak with you today. I know this is a tense, uncomfortable time with COVID-19 and the current election. If you're able to, please make sure to cast your vote. Your vote and your voice are a part of your power and your privilege. And you know, I encourage you to keep those who don't have this opportunity or privilege in mind once casting your vote. I decided to run for the student rep for Board of Trustees because I felt like it would be the perfect way to have an impact on the Cornell community. In choosing business schools, Cornell stood out to me as one of the most genuine, welcoming places to spend 2 years growing professionally and personally. As a member of the board, I promised to use my power and privilege to represent the student body to the best of my abilities. My ultimate goal is to foster an inclusive and supportive environment for all and ensure the university continues to be well regarded in the sphere of higher education. I understand that members of the Cornell community have been treated unfairly based on the color of their skin, and I plan to meet with members of Do Better Cornell to bring their demands, including issues around sexual harassment, racial discrimination, and accessibility for all members of Cornell's community to the board for full consideration. I will support the university in their efforts to keep us safe while introducing new strategies to provide access to various facilities for students' use within the confines of COVID-19 and the impact that it's had. I'll work with the Office of the President on addressing components that make up the college and various programs, graduate programs rankings, and continue to improve our position. And I'd also like to acknowledge that in my current position, I'm not privy to all the information made available to board members, but I'll always act in the best interest of the student body. I also plan to make myself accessible to hear any concerns from members of the Cornell community. Thank you for your time, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much. Our next candidate is Vince Hartman. You are recognized.
Hi, everyone. My name is Vince. I am currently a graduate student in Cornell Tech Information Systems. So I went to Cornell undergrad, and before I was working as a health care IT consultant for about 8 years prior to grad school. And I was involved in the assemblies before undergrad. I currently live in Manhattan. And I was actually here in New York City during the heart of the pandemic when there was like ambulances every 5 minutes and I got COVID myself. So the other day I was chatting with the dean of Cornell Tech and he asked me personally, like, why would I run for an Ithaca position and commit myself to responsibilities for Ithaca if I'm all the way here in New York City? Like, why would I be doing this? And my answer to him and to everyone, my primary one is, so back in March, when I saw the Board of Trustees announce this past spring that they were going to maintain the tuition increase, I was like personally distraught, like with everything that has changed so dramatically with our COVID pandemic and the value of Cornell being fundamentally altered with our hybrid approach. I felt deeply bothered by that decision. And that's what really affected me to run. So of all times, the tuition should not have been increased at Cornell. It was during a public health crisis when the majority of our classes are virtual. And I'm running because I know I'm the best candidate that can tell the board why a tuition increase for this upcoming school year is unwise for the image of Cornell. And I just want to tell the Board of Trustees that. The other major COVID issues that I'll mention that I'm going to champion is getting specific work from home resources for graduate students, ensuring that graduate students have a say of in-person versus virtual environment, and a COVID testing center downtown, and adding resources for mental health care providers. So to dive into one of those other ones, like while our whole world went virtual, there's been this presumption that graduate students and faculty have the capabilities already to cope with all these changes from a teaching and research perspective. And that has not always been the case, unfortunately. Like, for example, I know for me that with this whole like Zoom world, that my laptop is being strained in this whole environment. Like, I have an i3 processor and like it's 50% of the resources and it doesn't support virtual backgrounds. And so if like, if I was a graduate student TAing classes, if I had those classes, I'd be just like definitely struggling. So when I worked as a consultant, my job gave me the resources needed, and I imagine Cornell can do and should do the same thing. So in general, the university can and should do more for graduate students for COVID issues, such as this one and the other ones I mentioned, such as adding a resource center downtown. And then like for a complete list of my issues, such as continued support for the university for international students during times like this, I invite everyone to check out my website, vincehartman.com. And a vote for me is to make Cornell the best we can have during this COVID environment.
Okay, thank you very much, Vince. And our last candidate is Jeff P.
Hey, everyone. I hope everyone's doing well. I think kind of attesting to what all the other candidates had said, that I hope everyone is staying safe and staying healthy. Some of you may not know me, but some of you may do. My name is Jeff, pronouns he, him, and I'm currently a fourth year PhD student in the biomedical and biological sciences program. During my time here for the past, I guess, 4 years, which makes me realize how old I am. During my time here at Cornell, I've actually been able to have the opportunity to serve the Cornell community. Some of you may know me in my role in the GPSA, but I also sit on previous governance positions in the UA. I also had the fortunate opportunity this summer to represent graduate and professional students on the Cornell reopening committees during the height of the pandemic, or height is a little bit of a quotation marks. In these different experiences and through my time here at Cornell, I've realized that it was never an individual effort from me, but rather a collective effort in working collaboratively with groups across campus and amplifying their voices and concerns when I was in the position to provide input. And it was through these positions that I've been able to help champion a variety of different initiatives. If you recall last year in GPSA, things like the divestment vote that came through the GPSA, the campus circulator option through the GPSA, and in the summer advocating for graduate professional student rights as workers and also as employees of the university when it came to online and in-person teaching. Some of you may have also seen the grad and professional student survey that went out, as well as a report that came about, which kind of spearheaded a lot of the changes, not only at the grad school, but also university-wide. And that was an initiative that was done collectively within me and a large collection of grad students who really put in the effort to do that. So what I really wanted to point out was, in this role as student elected trustee, what I really hope to do is to continue that and foster that communication between the Board of Trustees and also the Cornell community. I think a lot of the other candidates point out really important issues as happening right now, the systemic injustice that's going across the nation, but also the concerns of the pandemic. I think there still needs to be need for graduate and professional students, such as a continued investment in the COVID-19 fund, as kind of what Vince was alluding to, the need to help support students, whether they're at home or even on campus. I think there also needs to be, in relation to the grad student survey, as well as the mental health survey that just got released, a real push for more mental health services, both in person and online. And I think there's a variety of ways that we can do that through Cornell Health and also through the variety of resources on campus. As well, for those of you who have been impacted by the pandemic in terms of research funding, this is something that we really do need to explore in terms of how to support those students whose research progression has been impacted intimately by the pandemic and how it's affected your plans. Lastly, I want to say that in terms of helping community groups, I've been able to communicate with a lot of groups on campus, especially through the GPS Diversity Council, and also being working with other groups on campus. And I think that there is a real need to keep the university accountable in terms of its diversity and inclusion efforts. And this includes increasing the investment and support for the upcoming Anti-Racism Center, things like adopting a campus-wide educational policy on anti-racism and bias training, and a lot of other things that are at the college level going down. So if you want to talk more about this, feel free to do so. I would be more than willing and happy to have a conversation. So shoot me an email. I'll provide my net ID below. I'll also provide a link to my website for more of those issues that I brought up and beyond that. So looking forward to the rest of the discussion of the meeting tonight.
All right, thank you very much, Jeff. So I'm afraid because we're running behind on the agenda, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut the question period. But instead, what I'd like for us to do instead is I would like to refer everyone to the candidate forum, which will be happening on Wednesday, where you have a chance to pose your questions to the candidates. And to all the candidates, thank you so much. And if you'd like to provide any of your information to the assembly, you can please do so in the chat, whether if you want to provide your NetID, if people have questions, or if you have like a website or whatever it may be, feel free to share that with us. But if not, thank you so much for taking the time to introduce yourselves in today's meeting today. And with that, I'd like to move on to the next order of business for today, which is the committee updates. I just have four committees for today that I'm going to ask for updates. The first is the executive committee. So Nicola Danef, do you have any updates?
No updates from the executive committee at this time. David gave them at the beginning.
Sure. communications, Kavya Krishnan.
So just two quick updates. One, I'm putting the Slack invite in the chat. So please feel free to join. A lot of these conversations that we don't have time for now can continue in the chat. And the second thing is I'm going to try to send out emails with just information that comes to us from organizations and administration. So please do, as a field rep, pass it on to your constituents. Any way, any form, like we're not trying to monitor that, but just please pass on that information.
Okay, thank you very much. And from operations, Mbardak Chatterjee?
No updates from me.
And from finance, Ariel Johnson?
Yeah, just an update of a policy that we're thinking about changing. Is currently no gifts are allowed to be purchased with finance commission money, but during the pandemic, a lot of organizations have wanted to have prizes for example, like virtual trivia events or that sort of thing. So I think that this is a change that a lot of people could get behind, but if you have any specific objections to the idea of allowing groups to have prizes for events and, you know, give a prize to the winner at some event, please contact me directly. Otherwise, I will be writing a resolution to try and push that forward.
Okay, and thank you very much. With that, I'd like to move on to the new business of today. So first, a few words about procedure when it comes to, we have two new resolutions. And going by the convention of past years, we are going to introduce these resolutions. We're going to debate them. We'll consider any amendments if there are any. And but we are not going to vote on them in this meeting. We are going to vote on them in the following meeting because our bylaws state that any resolution introduced into the GPSA has to be, Nick, are you making a point of order? Is that why you're raising your hand? Or
yes, I can't raise my hand virtually.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so in theory, there is a possibility to motion for a resolution to be voted on at the same meeting if people feel the need to do so, if there's an urgency to it. Just wanted to clarify that.
Right, because the bylaws say that we have to vote on any resolution within two meetings of the meeting in which it's proposed. So that could include this meeting. However, what I'm recommending to the assembly today is that since these are two very important resolutions and we want to give people the chance to get feedback from your constituents, that we debate them, introduce them, debate them, and then go back to your constituents and get their feedback on them. And then we can vote on them in the next meeting. And since one of them deals with the campus code of conduct, it'll still be within enough time for us to pass a resolution before the comment period ends. So unless someone makes an objection to that interpretation and that plan of action, then that's how I'd like for us to proceed with the two resolutions today. And so this will happen in four stages. I'll ask each of the sponsors to introduce the resolution. Then we're going to enter formal debate where anyone who wants to speak against or for the resolution itself, the substance of it, can do so. Then we close out a formal debate, we go into general debate, which is where we can ask general discussion. If we want to make amendments, that's where that would happen. And then after general debate is when we can make a motion on what to do with the resolution. So I'm recommending that we table the resolution at the end, unless someone makes a motion, say, to commit it to a particular committee, which is still an option that we can do. And this is something that voting members can do. Okay. So the first resolution is Resolution 2, condemning the proposed DHS ruling requiring a fixed period of stay for international students. This is sponsored by Kavya Krishnan. Kavya, would you like to please introduce the resolution? And if possible, can you share are you able to share your screen? Can you show us the text of it, or would you like me to do that?
I can do that. Give me a second.
Okay.
All right, can people see it?
Yes.
Sounds great. So this resolution is specifically talking about the DHS ruling that has just came out a little while ago, talking about limiting visa periods for international students. And specifically for those of you who are not international, visas for all students have a flexible time period. It's usually around 5 years, but it's determined by the school itself. So the school, so long as you are enrolled in a school, there's usually no issues with renewing your visas. Now, DHS wants to limit visas for students to 4 years for most countries. And then for certain countries in the Middle East and Africa, it wants to limit visas up to 2 years. So that's the main issue. We want to, mention that this is incredibly difficult for international students, because obviously for most PhD students, your time to degree is over 5 years. The two-year visa period also affects many professional students and master's students. It discriminates against students from specific countries. It's a huge financial burden. It affects graduate professional community more than the undergrads. We know that it doesn't affect the undergrads, but a lot more of the international students at Cornell are in grad and professional programs. Based off the rulings that have been coming up, both the July 6th ruling, which stopped international students from taking classes online, the changes to the H-1B visa, which I'm not mentioning, but is also an issue. There've been a lot of recent rulings that have been detrimental to international students. So this is of major concern. So basically, and also for people who will be applying to Cornell or any US institution, it's a huge issue, because why would you apply to a university if you're not sure you can actually complete your PhD career at it? So really quickly, the things that we're proposing is, one, we are very strongly opposing the rule. We're reiterating our support, and I'm gonna put this link in the chat, but we're also urging everyone to submit public comments at the Federal Register, and the deadline for that is today by 11:59. So please, please submit public comments. We're also recommending that Cornell administration increase staffing. One of the things we've been hearing is just because of the constant issues that have been coming up, everyone's trying to scramble to figure out how this ruling is to be interpreted, how it affects students. And so staff is really overwhelmed trying to deal with this. That's, I think, really important. Also, it's really important that they are designated to work with graduate and professional students who have very different issues with visas, because they're also employees, they work on research as opposed to classes. So the issues are pretty unique. We're recommending that Cornell either collaborate with, work with some kind of nonprofit or law organization that students can use for immigration issues, and also sensitizing faculty and staff to deal with some of these issues, and hiring of CAPS counselors to deal with the mental health issues that this brings up. That was it.
Okay, so we are now entering formal debate on the resolution. So if anyone would like to speak either in favor or against the resolution, please raise your hand in the participants chat. Nick, you're recognized.
Thank you. Sorry, I can't raise my virtual hand, so I did a check mark. I'd like to speak in favor of this resolution. I think it's extremely important that the GPSA recognizes this, and not only recognize it, but also informs the university that we expect them to take a stronger stance on this. This will affect the vast majority of graduate students at Cornell, not only international students. It will affect every single person at Cornell. Every person in the Ithaca area, every person in the United States of America will be affected by this and broader. And I think it's extremely important that we have a stance on this. And I fully agree with the points that Kavya has made in this resolution.
Thank you very much, Nick. Is there anyone else who would like to speak? Seeing none, I think we should move into the general debate. Is there anyone who would like to make a motion to make an amendment? Or if you have any questions for Kavya, you can do so now. Please raise your hand. Seeing none, is there
a... Jeff had a hand?
Oh, Jeff, were you raising your hand? Oh, yes, you did. Okay. Jeff, you're recognized.
You're unmuted.
Yeah. Is this for the open question period?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, Kavya. Do you know... what's the current staffing like in the office in terms of, because I guess it's, they have, and again, I need to look, but do they have the same staff for graduate and undergraduate students? And if so, how many?
Well, currently, I know they don't differentiate between staff for graduate and undergraduate. I don't know exactly how many people are there, but I know it's a small office. Like, I think last summer when we were talking, it was the executive director and then two people that dealt with international student issues. That might be more now, so I don't know the exact staffing number, but it is a low number. It's not a large office.
Any other hands?
Vince.
Okay. Oh, Vince, you recognized.
Yeah, I was curious if there were plans to send this resolution also to the undergraduate students after it's passed.
I can speak to this. I mean, they will see that we passed the resolution, and we obviously are in communication with, the student assembly. So, yes, they would be able to see it. Yeah.
I'd like to make a motion, David.
Yes. What is your motion?
I know that we said that we're going to table these, but I wasn't aware that the deadline closes tonight for comment. So I would like to motion to vote on this specific resolution unless someone opposes that.
Okay, but first we need to a motion to conclude debate. Is there a motion to conclude general debate on the resolution? Nick, you can do that if you want. You can move to click.
I was waiting to see if anyone had a question, but since
I can't see if there...
I do have a question, sorry.
Mila, you recognize?
Yes. So my question is how in the F1 visas, I understand it, but like in J1 visas, how far, like I don't see why Cornell has a ruling on that, because J1 visas is just the Department of State, and like I don't see how they have a decision, because under J1 visas you have Fulbright students, and like I don't see how it will make the difference, honestly. I think that this resolution should only be constrained to F1 visas holders, in my opinion.
So I can answer that. It is affecting both the DHS ruling affects both F1 students and J1 scholars. So I mentioned that in the first clause because I'm just mentioning that it does affect both of them. The rest of the resolution only talks about the issues because that's all we can represent. So I don't know enough about the issues of J1 scholars to be able to represent them in the things. This was more.
So that's what I'm saying. So you have PhD students who are also J1 visa holders.
As far as I'm aware, you cannot. You can be a visitor.
You can. I know. Like because there are a lot of Fulbright students who come with a J1 visa for the first 2 years, and then they switch to F1 visas. So I'm saying this resolution is not correct in the term that it should only be concerned to F1 visas. Because if you're mixing J1 and F1 as equal, it's just wrong. It's not correct.
What would you propose as like editing that line?
So I would say
you can make a motion to amend this if you want now, if you'd like, Mila. If you would like to.
But is there anybody else that thinks the way I think, or is it only? Okay, I motion to amend this resolution and to change the resolution only to be focused on F1 visa holders.
Okay, so there's been a motion to amend this such that any reference to what was it, J1 is removed and it's only F1. Is there a second to that motion? Nick, is that a second?
No, that was for open.
That was what?
No, that was for the debate on the amendment. I'm not seconding it.
Okay, so but is there a second on the motion to amend it according to this amendment? If there isn't, then the amendment has to be rejected. And there's no. Okay, seeing no seconding of this amendment, then the amendment fails, and we go back to general debate. So is there anyone who would like to speak in terms of general debate? Seeing none, is there a motion to conclude debate on this resolution?
I so motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any objections? All right. Seeing none, I can now entertain. Debate is now closed on this resolution, and I will now consider any motion to table the resolution, or to call a vote on it, or to send it to a committee. Is there any such motion? Nick.
Motion to vote.
Is there a second on a motion to vote on this resolution?
I'll second.
Are there any objections to voting?
Right. Point of order, don't we first have to move to suspend the bylaws that govern how the voting procedure for resolutions goes before we can move to vote?
Nick, do you want to answer that point of order?
The bylaws don't forbid us from voting on a resolution. It's only precedent. The bylaws say within 2 meetings of the proposal, and since this is within that time frame, we are within the scope of the bylaws, just outside of precedent.
So I wanted to recognize, because I knew this was an issue that was going to come up, is that in previous years we've interpreted it such that the resolution we would have to suspend the bylaws if we wanted to vote it on in this meeting, but it seems that we can interpret the bylaws in a different way. So I don't know if either Wendy or Gina would like to speak in terms of which is whether we might be allowed to vote on this without suspending the bylaws, or otherwise I recommend that we move forward with the vote.
This is Gina. I would just say that you are entitled to the interpretation, and as the president, I think that you have made your cases. You've allowed for enough discussion, and the body can vote either way.
Okay, in that case, I'm going to move forward with voting, since it seems that we I should call again. Are there any objections to voting on this resolution? Sorry, did someone just speak?
I just stopped sharing.
Okay. In that case, if you are all those in favor of the resolution, could you, and voting members only, please, please raise, click the green yes button in the participants chat. Only those who are in favor at this time. And I will. Okay, so I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, Nick's counts, Wendy, are you raising your hand? Yes.
Well, I just want to let you know you can count, but also you should be able to see as a co-host.
Oh, I see
yes,
it now.
No,
okay.
You'll see the number there. So rather than going through and counting the check marks, it counts it for you.
Okay, so there are 14 yes. Now, any who are opposed to the resolution, please click the red no. Okay, so seeing none then, it seems like we have 14 yes, and where are we at quorum today? So we were at, how many people did we have total who were, sorry, did someone? Because I believe that is a majority. Who was the person who took roll call? What is our total for today in terms of number of people? Because I believe it was only I don't have the number in front of me, so I don't know how many total voting members we have today.
I believe I counted 16.
16. So we have 14 out of 16. Yes. And so that means two abstentions. The resolution passes. Okay. We'll now move on to the next resolution, which is resolution 3 on the proposed changes to the student code of conduct. Sponsored by Nick Deneff. Could you please present your resolution?
Yes. Hi. So first off, just a reminder, please change your name so that Gina can put you into the breakout rooms when we need to. At the end of this resolution, I'm also going to motion to not end our meeting at 7, but extend it by 10 minutes. So I am going to share my screen just so you all can see the resolution. Okay, perfect. So the resolution is on the proposed changes to student code of conduct, which we heard about, from our two guest speakers today. So just briefly, Cornell had a public forum, but they only gave 2 days of notice for the public forum. And also it was in the peak of a global pandemic and they gave the wrong Zoom link to the entire community. So people couldn't really attend this. A lot of constituencies represented by the GPSA have voiced concerns about the new student code of conduct. And based off of what we were told by both of our speakers, we actually do support some of the changes that the University Council has proposed, but I also do believe that some changes should be opposed. So the abbreviated version is in the resolution here, but the supplement file has all of the reasoning. So I'm just briefly going to go over all of the changes and whether I think we should support them or not support them. And since this is a very substantial resolution, I figured we're going to need a little bit more time to think about this. But so the GPSA opposes the first change, which I've listed here, and that is the change that both the complainant and the respondent should be given the opportunity to question witnesses directly. The new change to the code would not allow for this to happen. And also it would eliminate the ability for the JCC to actually speak on behalf of their clients or the people that they represent, which, as we heard earlier, would become a problem for people that, you know, don't feel comfortable speaking on their own behalf, or English isn't their first language, or they're just new to the whole procedure, or they find it inaccessible. Then also, I think we should oppose the JCC becoming a part of the OJA, because the OJA is the person that is usually the body that that will lodge a complaint against you. So I think people wouldn't be able to trust the people representing them if the people representing them are also from the same office as the people charging them. So also clear and convincing evidence standard, I think, better advances the principles of fairness and due process. In hearings, you know, you have teenagers that have never had to deal anything with anything like this before, and they go against the Office of the Judicial Administrator, which are full-on lawyers. So you have these teenagers that have to defend themselves from actual experienced adult lawyers. And then we're making it so that the lawyers have it easier to prove that these people are guilty. I think that doesn't make a lot of sense. And also, it's very important to note that we're keeping this separate from Title IX. I fully agree that for Title IX, we need to have a preponderance of evidence. But I think that for cases that do not apply to Title IX, we need to have clear and convincing evidence, as was the case in the past. And I can talk about my previous university. So I was at Columbia. We had preponderance of evidence. And I know personally that that is a huge point of contention and a serious issue for a lot of students that get accused of these things. We do oppose also the fact of that they've completely removed any statement of being afforded the assistance of an advisor provided through the JCC. We think it's important to not only allow this, but also inform students that they do have the right to an advisor. Also, I think we should oppose the change to having absolutely no public hearings. I think it's a little, I don't know, authoritarian is the only word that comes to mind when I think of, being taken into this secret meeting and then not being allowed to discuss it and no one can know the outcome or what happened. I think if we allow for public hearings, we can have more accountability for the people enforcing the rules. And then also we do support, as I said, there are some things that I think are good. The Office of the Complaints Code Counselor is supported, something that is not previously existent. I do also think we need to oppose the changes to shifting temporary suspensions should not be unilaterally imposed. And we do think that the standard for temporary suspension should not be lowered, because you do get a temporary suspension before you're found guilty of anything. It is as a preventive measure. So I don't think we should be just giving those out without really having a real reason to do it. Of course, I think it's important to allow for extraordinary circumstances for the purpose of ensuring public order and safety, but not just whenever the Office of Student Conduct feels like they should give one out, that they should be able to do that. I also think we should oppose the change that the statute of limitations is being changed. Currently, it's 1 year. And with what they're proposing, it just, you can bring up anything from that happened at any point in history. So I think that we do need to keep a statute of limitations, because evidence does tend to deteriorate over time. I do think we should support the changes that allow more opportunities for resolution through restorative justice and not actually a hearing. And I do think that we should be okay with granting the university jurisdiction over all registered students, regardless of where they are, especially important during times like this when we're not all physically present on campus. So that's kind of a brief overview of the resolution, but yeah.
Okay, so real quick, since it's now 7 p.m., is there a motion to extend the meeting time at all by 10 minutes? I promise that we will try to wrap things up within that time period.
Yes, I'm motioning to extend by 10 minutes.
All right, is there a second?
Seconded.
All right, any objections from the voting members? All right, seeing none, the meeting is extended by 10 minutes. We will now enter formal debate on the resolution. Would anyone wish to speak? Seeing none, we'll now move into general debate. Any questions for Nick? Any amendments that would like to be made now? Now is the time. If so, please raise your hand, or if you can't raise your hand, speak up. Okay, seeing none, is there a motion to conclude debate for today?
Motion to conclude debate on this resolution.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, any objections to that concluding debate? All right, seeing none, debate is concluded for today. Is there a motion for this resolution? So we recommend that since it's a very considerably sized resolution, and we would like for to vote for it next meeting, where we can continue debate, we can continue to consider amendments. Is there a motion to table this resolution?
Motion to table the resolution.
All right, is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, any objections to tabling the resolution? All right, seeing none, this resolution is tabled until the next meeting. Okay, so now, and since we have not very much time left, I ask everyone to fill out the form for attendance. And what I recommend that we do, I would like for us to, what we can do, and then since we have 10 minutes left, we can, I recommend that we suspend division breakouts for this meeting and instead have open forum while everyone fills out the form, and then we can conclude the meeting. Are there any objections to that, changing the agenda in that way? Okay, seeing none, I think we would like to move now into open forum. And in the meantime, everyone please take attendance on the survey that was just put in the chat. Anyone who would like to speak? Okay. Seeing none, I'll just give maybe one more minute to, Jeff, is your hand? Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, no worries. So this is just a continuation off of the very, very first thing that was talked about in the meeting, which was committing hirings for the university assembly. So there is a fourth committee that does require a GPAC representative. It doesn't matter if it's a voting member or not. And that's the campus planning committee. And so they work alongside the infrastructure committee, and I'm bringing up the description. They look at comprehensive and clear planning processes for the Ithaca campus. So they review and make recommendations to the president regarding the physical planning of campus. So landscape architecture, transportation planning, parking, infrastructure. So they are looking for a graduate and professional student rep. The main caveat is that this is a 2-year term. So you'll have to think long-term as to whether or not you want to commit to that. But if you have any interest in it, reach out to David, anybody on the exec team, or anybody that is on the UA.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Would anyone else like to speak? Nick?
No. Yeah, please fill out the form, because I am seeing that only 12 people have filled it out. Your organization's funding is contingent on filling out the form.
Yes, all members, not just voting members, please.
I was going to say, quick note, I have put the link on submitting comments for the DHS ruling, as well as the Slack link again.
Okay. Okay, if no one else is going to fill it out, then I guess we can make a motion to conclude the meeting. Would anyone like to make such a motion?
Motioning
to what?
To conclude the meeting.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Any objections to concluding the meeting at this time? All right, seeing none, the meeting is now concluded. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.